decision because things seem much better.
That's the pollster and political consultant, now Labour peer Deborah Mattinson. And you can hear our full conversation by subscribing to the Ian Dale All Talk podcast on Global Player. Now, coming up in a moment, it's Wednesday's edition of Cross Question. We have with us Chris Curtis, the Labour MP for Milton Keynes North, Alex Wilson, Reform UK member of the London Assembly, Angela Epstein, journalist and broadcaster, and Naomi Smith, chief executive of Internationalist campaign group Best for Britain. So they're here to answer your questions. Could be on anything to do with today's news. We like the oddball question as well. There's a challenge for you. 0345 6060973. That's the number to call or send a WhatsApp message, or you can text 84850 and you can watch us on Global Player.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 8 o'clock, Benjamin Netanyahu's claimed Israel has eliminated senior Hamas leader Mohamed Sinwar. It's believed he was targeted during a strike on a hospital in southern Gaza in which 28 people were killed. The IDF hasn't been able to confirm his death. Yotam Confino is a reporter for The Telegraph based in Jerusalem.
When you have Netanyahu saying that Sinwar has been killed, but you don't have a confirmation from the IDF or from Hamas, I would take it with a grain of salt. I would also say that same time, it does look like he was at least targeted and perhaps also killed.
Brothers Andrew and Tristan Tate have been charged with rape and other crimes. The Crown Prosecution Service says the pair will be extradited to Britain once a case against them in Romania is over. Detectives investigating a crash in Liverpool on Monday have been given more time to question a 53-year-old man. He's being held on suspicion of attempted murder and drug driving after a car was driven into crowds at a Premier League title parade. And a review into the decision to close Heathrow Airport following a power outage has found that bosses made the right call. The airport was closed for almost a day back in March following a fire at a nearby substation. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed down 52 points, 87.26. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.19. LBC weather, heavy rain in the north tonight, lighter in the far south and southeast, a low of 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC, from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Cross Question, with Ian Dale.
Hello, a very good evening. It's 2 minutes past eight on LBC. We had a crack of a cross question last night. We're going to have another one tonight with our excellent panel. With me in the studio is Chris Curtis, Labour MP for Milton Keynes North. Alex Wilson is Reform UK member of the London Assembly. Angela Epstein, journalist and broadcaster. And Naomi Smith, chief executive of the Internationalist Campaign Group. That sounds terribly grand. Best for Britain. The number to call if you'd like to put a question to my panel. 0345 6060973. You can of course WhatsApp your questions. We're getting an increasing number of WhatsApp questions. You can text 84850, say Alexa send a comment to LBC, and you can email Ian, I-A-I-N, at lbc.co.uk, and of course you can watch us on Global Player.
Call 0345 6060973, tweet at LBC, text 84850, Cross Question with Ian Dale. This is LBC.
Well, let's start with a question from James in Hitchin. James says, in an era where we're apparently ever concerned with our mental health, why on earth would you consider decriminalising dangerous mind-altering drugs like cannabis? Now, a bit of background to this. The London Drugs Commission, which is chaired by the former Labour Justice Secretary, Lord Charlie Faulkner, has recommended that possession of small quantities of cannabis for personal use should be decriminalised. The London Mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan, has supported this recommendation, but the Home Office says it has no intention of changing the law. Well, Alex Wilson, you're on the London Assembly. I guess this is something that you're going to have to deal with. We're talking about this in our 9 o'clock hour, so people will be able to phone in with their views. What's your view?
Sure. Well, it's a very good question, so thank you for submitting that. I'm actually going to start perhaps slightly uncharacteristically in saying where I do agree with Sir Sadiq, which doesn't happen very often at all, and I do agree with him and with the report suggesting that it's not in anyone's interest to criminalise and give a criminal record which can have long-lasting consequences for anyone for having possession of a small amount of cannabis for personal use. I think it's insane to do that. Now, if we have a system of drug regulation and health support which is based on relative risk, then to treat cannabis in that way, when in many people's views it is less harmful than tobacco and alcohol, I think is wrong. However, that's where I stop. I don't agree with the way that the report has tried to frame this as a question of race and viewed it through that prism and saying, oh, well, we need to criminalise it because the current laws are disproportionately affecting people from certain backgrounds, in much the same way as I don't agree that those people who want to cut the use of stop and search do so because they think it tackles disproportionate certain groups. I think everybody should have a good chance to start in life, and it shouldn't, regardless of your race or your background, you shouldn't be penalised by this, and you shouldn't also, by the same measure, be exempt from stop and search and getting knives on the street. But ultimately, you have to ask, why is he talking about this at all? It's not something that, as Mayor of London, he has any power over of. I think it's a deflection from where he's actually failing on the real things on crime, the fact that there is a rape reported every hour, 70,000 phones stolen in the last year on London streets, only 2% of burglaries resulting in a charge or summons in outer London, knife incidents up 17% in the last year. He's failing on the bread and butter of crime and policing. He's using this as a deflection from that, and I think those are the real questions that we also need to be getting to.
Well, isn't he just responding to a report that's been published?
It's report from a body that comes within his orbit. So he set this up and it's now reported and he's commented on it.
Well, it'd be a bit odd if he didn't respond to it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but why did he set this up in the first place? The whole thing, it's a distraction. The fact is, London streets are much less safe now under Sadiq Khan than they have been previously for all those reasons that I've mentioned, the rising knife crime. And ultimately, he's made a political choice. He talks about spending a lot of money on policing. And to be fair, he does, £1.1 billion.
But you're agreeing with him. He says he thinks it should be decriminalised, so do you. So why can't you just agree with him?
Because you've asked us the question, and we'll see what the other panellists say as well. You've asked us the question. I've given you my personal view. I'm making it clear it's very much a personal view. I don't think it's necessarily a view shared by many others in the party, indeed many in my own office, or people in my office don't necessarily share that view. But it's my personal view. The fact is, Sadiq is failing on crime. That's what we need to hold him to account for.
Angela Epstein.
Well, I don't live in London, so I'm taking a step back when I look at Sadiq Khan, because the things that he does in terms of the kind of local effect or impact doesn't have any jurisdiction over me. When I look at the Sadiq Khan position on this, I just think he's saying, I am my own man, because his position on this, on decriminalisation, is not chiming with traditional Labour or the Labour agreed position, which is absolutely not to do this. He's showing he's his own man, and maybe he's looking ahead a bit down the road to where his political ambitions will take him next. He's trying to maybe attract that centre-right, the young professionals. It's quite liberal. Maybe those are all the things going through his mind. I'm not a mind reader, so I don't know. What I would say where this is concerned is I absolutely think it sends out the wrong message if we decriminalise cannabis or we liberalise the laws in any way. I know the data is quite conflicting about whether it does act as a gateway to more serious addiction. I know that there's studies that prove it and disprove it. But I do think it reduces the stigma. It regularises kind of this idea of habitual cannabis use. It has been linked, as I think it's James you mentioned, was the WhatsApp contributor, mental health, depression, memory loss, cognitive impairment, and could it fuel a broader drug use? Why should we even take the chance? I think it's just a gamble that we don't need to take.
Is it a gamble, though? Can we not look at other countries that have gone down this road?
Yeah, well, so we have. This is why I mentioned other countries, Holland, for example, and the data is very conflicting, as I said, because some have said, yes, it's great. It means because it's become regular and there's no kind of chasing the dragon anymore, literally, it's just something that's normal, then people aren't seeing it as a way to chasing more significant drug use and harder drug use. And other places, it hasn't worked that way. I would not like to know that my children live in a country where it is perfectly legal to access cannabis.
Yvonne in Hastings wants you to know that she's a big fan of you. She sees you on Channel 5.
Okay, thank you, Yvonne. Thank you.
You have a fan. Alex, have a fan
as well.
It's
not my auntie either.
Says Alex Wilson really impressed me with that answer.
Oh, that's very kind.
Now, let's see if we can make it a hat-trick with Naomi Smith. No pressure.
Well, I think that what Alex is saying is, on the one hand, he agrees that, we shouldn't be penalising people for a very small amount of natural, non-synthetic cannabis and that determining the rest of their life because you're giving them a criminal record. And on the other hand, saying we need to be tackling wider crime issues across London, because I think the purpose of this is to say, instead of having police nicking everybody that's got a little bit of, you know, weed in their pocket, if they weren't having to do that, they would be freed up to tackle the things that I, as a Londoner, do really care about, things like phone theft, which really has skyrocketed in recent years. And, you know, people are afraid to use Google Maps when they don't know where they're going. You know, my mum is 76. I worry about her. I always say to her, don't have your phone out when you're walking back from the tube.
It happened to me. I was looking at Google Maps.
Well, there you go. You see, so I think what this would hopefully do is, on the one hand, have a very, very low risk impact on health outcomes and hopefully a very much bigger opportunity for the police to free up their time to go after the crimes that absolutely are devastating lives and need to be tackled. When we look at other countries, we can look at Portugal, for instance, where they legalised most drugs and, you know, go far further than anything like this. And they've seen an absolutely extraordinary fall in HIV rates, in admissions and things like that, and they very much approached it from a mental health perspective, that treating addiction as a mental health issue, with people self-soothing by choosing to self-medicate with drugs, and that has really improved outcomes. Lisbon was the drugs capital of the world, I think, you know, was certainly the developed world before that legislation came in. So I do think that we do need to consider looking at a more grown-up approach to legalising low risk, as Alex said, you know, alcohol far more likely to lead you to cause crime, to have very serious ill health, than any evidence from a small amount of cannabis. But we do need education. These things can really alter young minds, and we do need to make sure that education around drugs is as available as it can be for young people so that they can make an informed choice.
Chris Curtis.
Yeah, no, I broadly agree with, well, I agree with most of what everyone said, but I'm not convinced by the case for decriminalisation, mostly for the reasons that Angela said previously about this is not something that we want to destigmatise, given the impacts that it has on people's lives, particularly young people. I mean, the question was about mental health and the effects that has. The truth is we really don't know the extent that the mental health effects that cannabis has on people, but this country is going through a mental health crisis and we shouldn't be looking for ways to make that worse. But we spend a lot of time talking about this decriminalisation argument, and I see both sides here, but actually the much bigger question is, what can we do in order to support people with addictions, whether that's cannabis, other substances, alcohol, because we have real addiction problems right across this country. What can we do to help and support people with that? What money and support can our NHS be put in,
and if the
in that preventative work, because it costs us so much if we don't fix these problems early.
But if the evidence is, as Naomi says, that decriminalisation actually reduces dangerous drug use, then why wouldn't you want to look at it properly? Report clearly is, they've done a lot of research into it.
I haven't read the report yet.
Well, me neither, but I assume they have.
I haven't read the report. I take the point. I'm not convinced yet by the argument, particularly given that, you know, I'm not convinced yet by the argument that decriminalisation does help and support in that. But I accept the argument that is something that we should be open to.
I always think it's interesting in this debate where politicians often adopt a much more liberal attitude when they're not in government. And then, I mean, Alan Duncan was always a classic example of this, where he wrote a book called Saturn's Children, advocating decriminalisation, I think, across the board. And then as soon as he became a shadow spokesperson, basically had to disown his own words.
Politicians also, I say this as like a former pollster, right? Like, politicians also think that the public have got far more conservative attitudes on this than they do. And actually, if you look at the polling, if you look at the polling, voters are broadly in the space of being fairly open-minded and wanting to support what works. And that's certainly where I am, and the sort of policies that I'd advocate for. Am I convinced that decriminalisation would work? No, I'm not. But we've got to look at what is going to decrease substance misuse across this country, because it's having such a negative impact on our health service and on people's quality of life.
And it's a bit like the argument on assisted dying, isn't it? There is a sort of ratchet effect here, the so-called slippery slope argument, where if you decriminalise cannabis, then there is a certain logic to decriminalising more drugs. And where do you draw the line? And I think a lot of people, maybe particularly on the right, and I would include myself in this, have been on a bit of a journey where I used to be a sort of fight the war on drugs person, but we've lost it. And we can't re-win it, can we?
Well, yeah, but the thing is, this report, to me, is semaphore for the fact that cannabis is harmless and it is acceptable. Well,
for a lot of people, it is.
Well, OK. Well, I absolutely robustly disagree with that for all the things that I've said about memory loss and mental health. And, you know, I've interviewed in my work as a health journalist families who've been devastated by young people who've developed psychosis as a result of habitual cannabis use. I just ain't buying
it. That's not anywhere near the majority.
It doesn't matter. I'm not buying it because I don't think it's worth the risk.
But the extension of that logic is to ban alcohol. Because the evidence shows that you are far more likely to suffer poor mental health outcomes, poor physical health outcomes, as a consequence of even light to moderate drinking, let alone binging. So I think if we want to be evidence-led, and gambling and all sorts
But alcohol is we do it in a socially conservative way. It can be moderated. It can be presented.
Have you been in Leicester Square on a Friday?
No, but try Manchester, love. Okay. But, you know, we sort of look at it in different ways in social settings. We take social cues from different people in terms of alcohol. Cannabis is an entirely different... It's an entirely different universe. I don't think they're
comparable. Well, I don't think it is, because, if you get high on cannabis, you've lost control of all of your faculties, which is exactly the same as if you get rat-arsed.
But equally, we can promote a way that alcohol can be enjoyed in a conservative, small c, situation. I don't think you can do that with cannabis. It is a drug, and there is always the risk that with that drug, as I've said, that once it's sort of the impact wears off, people think, well, what's next? What's next on the menu?
Well, I mean, when you speak to people that have got severe epilepsy, for instance, and parents that struggle to try and find treatment, and they tell you cannabis is one of the only things that can reduce my child's symptoms, and they're having to break the law.
But that's medicalised cannabis. Okay, so then there's a separate conversation about
not everybody that smokes a spliff or has a hash brownie or whatever form these children are able to take some cannabis into their system. They're not getting off their heads and suffering from psychosis.
Okay, but that's an entire... respectfully, it's an erroneous argument, because that's a medicalised use of it.
But why couldn't... If we have normalised and socialised a small-c conservative approach to alcohol, which actually we haven't, and binge drinking is on the up, and, you know, it is a real endemic across the country in terms of the amount of alcohol abuse that's happening, particularly as people can no longer afford to go out to the pub, and a cost of living crisis is something that we can talk about at length, I'm sure, then why couldn't we also have a more conservative approach to legalised, regulated, standard-set cannabis consumption as well? I mean,
because that would be framed by a medical argument. I think, respectfully, they're entirely different animals.
Right. Well, we're not going to solve this now, but we will be solving it between 9 and 10 on this programme, and we want to get everybody's views on this, so store up a few phone calls for then. We'll move on to other subjects in just a moment. You're listening to LBC. It's 17 minutes past 8.
This is LBC. The legendary George Smiley is back. It's spring 1963, a Russian agent has defected in the most unusual of circumstances, and Smiley will soon find himself entangled in a perilous mystery that will strike at the heart of his greatest enemy. Return to the spy world of John le Carré with the gripping Sunday Times best-selling thriller Carla's Choice by award-winning novelist Nick Harkaway. Out now in paperback.
Barclays ready-made investments. The clue's in the name. Not Barclays' Where Do I Begin investments. You can start from £50. That's why they're not difficult to get started investments either. And you can choose your risk level. So they're hardly in at the deep end investments. So if you've got savings and you want to help grow your money over 5 years or more, then search Barclays ready-made investments. Make money work for you. Investing is not for everyone. The value of investments can fall as well as rise, and you may get back less than you invest. T's and C's apply.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's That's assist to 78900.
Cross Question with Ian Dale. Watch live on both Global Player and the new LBC app.
19 minutes past 8. Oh dear, one or two of you are clutching your pearls at a word I used a moment ago, saying, it's not before the watershed. Disgusting vernacular. Okay. Sorry. Robbie is in Chelmsford. Hello, Robbie.
Good evening, Ian. Good evening, panel. So I'm on one of those vexed NHS waiting lists. In fact, I'm on there twice, and I'm awaiting a life-changing operation. As I wait, I'm in, not extreme, but some pain every single day. However, I fully support the resident doctors, I have to get the word right, in their seeking of pay restoration. And I just ask openly, why should we expect public health workers to accept pay erosion?
Can you explain to me something that I failed to explain to my listeners in the last hour, where they put in a claim for 35% to do just what you said, to restore the pay levels back to 2008. They got 22% in July, so obviously not the full restoration. And now they're saying they need 29% for full restoration. The maths don't add up there, Robbie, do they?
The percentages are monstrous, but as with my physics degree... Yes, can explain it, but basically the percentages make it all very confusing because of the way that the inflation index has moved over time. But suffice to say, while it is a stupid way of them communicating, I admit, they are basically trying to get parity back with where they were before the financial crash.
Well, anyone that has a physics degree has my automatic respect because I got ungraded in my physics O-level, Robbie. Right, let's start with Naomi on this one.
Well, Robbie, sorry to hear about your situation and do hope that you get fast-tracked up that list very, very soon and you can overcome the issues that you're facing. I worry about recruitment of doctors. I worry about the number of medical students that say, actually, life is easier if I emigrate to Australia. And they can do that very easily under the youth mobility scheme we have in place with Australia, with other routes for the points-based system in Australia that they, as a medical professional, qualify for. And they work less gruesome hours and they have far, far better rates of pay. And I don't think many people go into studying medicine in this country hoping that they will get a job elsewhere. They desperately want to be NHS doctors and support the NHS and their own country and treat people here. So I do worry that if we don't deal with the pay issue, that we are going to face an even more critical situation with vacancies within the NHS. I would extend the exact same concern to nurses and midwives, who are also in very short supply, and entirely the care sector as well, social care and people being able to leave hospital with a care package in place. Now, bed blocking ever more because there are so few social care workers able to look after them. So for me, I'm worried about our ability to recruit and retain medical professionals in this country, trained in brilliant medical schools around the UK, unless this pay deal is sorted out.
And do you think the government should cave into it?
I think they need to negotiate well with them. Wouldn't we all love to have our pay restored to parity with 2008-09 levels and 14 years of austerity and very, very sluggish growth and galloping inequality between wealth and income in this country means that most of us are not earning anything close to what we thought we would be so far on from the crash. So it does sound like a big number. They did get a good deal last summer, and it was great that the health secretary was able to negotiate that and end it
immediately. But he's made a rod for his own back, hasn't he?
Well, I think there is still more to be done, and negotiations are going to continue. But, you know, the Wes Streeting himself has said the NHS treats doctors like crap.
But the...
He's got to keep this thing going.
You're going to upset Neville using that word. But I reckon that if you add up all of those different groups you just mentioned there, well, not a single one of us is going to say that they don't deserve to be paid more, but I reckon you've just increased public spending by 100 billion.
I don't know. I'm not the health secretary. But what I do know is that we have a cherished NHS, free at the point of use. Long may that continue. That is what the public supports. But it is broken. And it has had underinvestment for decades now. Okay. And that's got to change.
Chris Curtis.
Yeah, no, look, so firstly, Robbie, I'm sorry to hear about your situation. I hope we can bring those waiting lists down and see you get the care that you need as soon as possible. And look, we do have to acknowledge that doctors have been treated pretty appallingly over the past couple of decades. Their pay has been slashed. Many junior doctors are working outrageously long hours for wages.
I'm not using this as an excuse, but that's nothing new. This was an argument going on in the 70s and 80s. But
it's got significantly worse, the real-term pay cuts that we've had for doctors over the last 14 years. They've always done incredibly long working hours, but they've been treated appallingly with wages over the last 14 years. And look, we do need to start treating our doctors better in this country. We started that process with a decent pay agreement last year, but ultimately, eventually, this clashes with the fact that, you know, because of best part of two decades of very, very little economic growth, there is billions of pounds missing from the Treasury because of the mismanagement of the economy by the last government. And eventually, the fact that doctors have been treated appallingly, the fact they've had their wages cut, the speed at which we can restore that pay is basically down to the speed at which we can get our economy going again. We've been generous, we've moved quickly, but we can only move quicker in restoring that pay for them, the rest of our public servants, and actually people who work in the private sector as well, if we start getting our economy growing again as quickly as
possible. Angela Rupstein.
I'm sorry, it's very basic to me. Doctors, when they qualify, take the Hippocratic Oath, which is do no harm. It's complete anathema to what they do, as our caller has demonstrated. And I echo that my panellists, in terms of wishing you a speedy resolution to your problem, your health problems, is that by withdrawing services, how are they not contravening that Hippocratic Oath? It is outrageous, in my view, that doctors are even allowed to strike. The police aren't allowed to strike. The army aren't allowed to strike. They put members of the public in an arm lock. We become a captive audience unless you've got private healthcare. Obviously, they need to be paid well because they study for many years and they have a highly skilled job. There were 44 days of industrial action last year, and they got a no-strings-attached pay rise of, you mentioned, 22%. Another inflation-busting pay rise this year of, what is it, 5%, 5.4%?
No, that's the offer.
Another offer. Okay, but it's likely to be. Okay, in fairness, it's likely to be at least that then, isn't it, judging by the way the government has conducted itself. This is about public confidence. We sort of treat the NHS as a religion. You know, you mentioned, Naomi, that, you know, from the cradle to the grave, it's there as at the point of need. And all those things are true. But it completely erodes public goodwill if we see them withdrawing services. Now, there are lots of things that need to improve in the health service that money won't buy. And there are people in my family who are doctors. I've got lots of friends who are doctors, or their kids are. You know, the actual working conditions, morale, staff levels, the bureaucracy. We saw how many fat cat managers are earning huge amounts of money within the health service for their managerial and bureaucratic roles. The whole thing needs a root and branch investigation and an overhaul. But this idea of you constantly feed junior, they're not junior doctors, sorry, what do they call them?
Resident doctors,
by constantly giving them more money. Remember, they're public sector, so their pensions are protected. They have job security. That doesn't mean that they can be treated badly, but nor should it also mean that everything they want, they should be given. We want to treasure our doctors and treat them well and give them the money they deserve. But it's for the birds, the vast numbers that you mentioned, the 29%. I mean, it's just bonkers.
Alex Wilson.
Yeah, well, as with the three other panellists, Robbie, I wish you a speedy recovery and hope you get the treatment you need and deserve to get. It's a difficult question. The NHS is a fundamental part of our society, and it's ingrained in the way that we work and live and exist as a country. And I have friends and close family who work in the NHS as doctors and other positions, and I have nothing but the utmost respect and admiration for the work that they do in difficult circumstances. Yes, morale is often a challenge, overwork, the difficult conditions, difficult patients sometimes even, let alone the conditions that are trying to be treated with them. But these pay numbers are simply not realistic. I think having had the big uplift last year. I would ask the unions, I'd share what Chris has said, the offer that's on the table, it is a fair one, a more than fair one. I think when the average increase in pay across the economy is looking about 3.5% across the sort of similar timescale, then all this has to be paid for. We have... we're in danger of becoming a country attached to a health service rather than the health service that's there to support the country. And yes, a lot of money needs to be spent, and it needs to be spent in the right ways. And yes, we need to keep the staff on board and retained and create an incentive for new staff to come forward. We need to lift the cap on training places as well. I think that would help bring new staff into the service. But fundamentally, all this has to be paid for, and we have to remember that in order to pay for all the public services, that we, whether it's the health service, whether it's education, whether it's welfare, whether it's the armed forces, the police, all of that needs to be paid for, and all of that needs to be paid for by a dynamic and thriving private sector.
That's an interesting point you've made about the cap on training places. I've never worked out, why is there a cap on training doctors and nurses in this country when we're recruiting them from overseas? It seems mad.
It's ridiculous.
I don't know the answer.
And I've known this personally through members of the family. They also have a bottleneck when they finish their pre-reg years and they start choosing their specialty. I'm not using all the right terminology. There are more people than jobs, even though they've already been 4 years plus trained after leaving medical school. They have this odd system where you're competing to get jobs to continue your training. The whole system is lousy, and I think that's the problem, not chucking more and more money at it, because there's still oversubscribed applications for medical school. There's still plenty of people in this country who want to be doctors, but the system itself is creaking, and that's what has to be addressed. A decent government will do that rather than just keep giving them more money.
Right, we're going to move on to other subjects. Robbie, good luck with the operation whenever you get it, hopefully very, very soon. 0345 6060973 is the number to call. It's 8:30, and here's Daryl Jackson with the news headlines.
Israeli forces say they can't confirm the death of Hamas leader Mohammed Sinwar, though Benjamin Netanyahu says he has been eliminated. It's believed he was killed during a strike on a hospital in southern Gaza in which 28 people were killed. Prosecutors have confirmed for the first time that Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan are facing 21 charges in the UK. The allegations include rape, human trafficking and actual bodily harm against three women. They've previously denied any wrongdoing. Two police officers who used a taser and pepper spray on a 92-year-old man who used a wheelchair have been cleared of assault. Care home staff had called 999 after Donald Burgess grabbed a table knife and threatened to stab them. LBC weather, heavy rain in the north tonight, light rain in the far south and southeast, a low of 6 degrees.
This is LBC. Car owners, you could be owed thousands in compensation. If you bought a car on finance from 2007 onwards, it may have been sold with hidden commissions. My claim group is working hard to help. So, even if you've forgotten your details, make sure you check. Text CLAIM to 86688. My claim group is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Text CLAIM to 86688.
Claims made simple. Big, big, big motoring world.
Wow, wow,
wow motoring world.
Yes, that's right. Big Motoring World is also Wow Motoring World because we price check our cars every day to guarantee you our best price, with up to 95% of them below market value. Big Motoring World, we're big on what matters to you. See website for nearest store. Visit bigmotoringworld.co.uk or one of our stores for our price promise and terms and conditions.
Amazon offers employees up to £8,000 for education and training, like Juliet. She's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £8,000 for education and training at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
Cross Question with Ian Dale on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
8:33 on LBC. We have on the panel tonight Chris Curtis, Labour MP for Milton Keynes North, Alex Wilson, Reform UK member of the London Assembly, Angela Epstein, journalist and broadcaster, and Naomi Smith, chief executive of the internationalist campaign group Best for Britain. Have you sort of rejigged a bit and this internationalist bit? I've never read that out before when you've been on the programme.
I mean, pro-European, pro-internationalism, open society. We'll take whatever you want to call it.
Okay, fine. Right, let's go to Martin in Doncaster. Now, Martin, you're about to put the cat among the pigeons, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yeah. Yeah, thanks for the brilliant show, as usual, Ian. The question is this. Does Nigel Farage need Dominic Cummings' help to be the next Prime Minister?
Now, Boris Johnson's former chief advisor has said today that Nigel Farage could definitely become Prime Minister after the next general election in 2029 or 2028, but believes that Reform has been a one-man band. It's been Nigel and an iPhone, and that no party can win an election and then achieve anything in government on that basis. Alex Wilson, we have to come to you first on this, don't we? Would you like a bit of help from Dominic Cummings?
Well, I think any political party that's serious about trying to get itself in a position to win an election would be, you know, very wise to listen to any offers of suggestions of advice and help that could get us along the way. However, I fundamentally disagree with the assertion that Reform is just about Nigel Farage and an iPhone. The party would not exist at all if it hadn't been for Richard Tice and the time and effort and indeed money that he put into the organisation, keeping the party going after the 2009 election and before things picked up again last year, but we're also growing massively organically. What we've got now as a party, as a structure, a branch structure, which we've never had before, and it's those candidates that are coming through, the chairman, the branches that are getting organised. We've got about 420, I think, now branches in constituencies up and down the country, and the fruits of that were shown in those local elections that we had just a few weeks ago, winning 10 councils, far beyond anyone's expectation, actually getting more candidates nominated than any other party in those elections, whereas in the local elections last year, we only contested, I think, 12% of vacancies. So there's been a huge amount of work going on behind the scenes at head office as well, under the chairmanship of Zia Youssef, getting the structure in place, getting the systems in place, and, as I say, rolling out those branches. So, yes, Nigel obviously is hugely important for everything we've achieved. And the fact that when he came back during the election, it gave us, well, Chris can probably confirm, about a 5-point boost from start to finish of that campaign in the opinion polls. But everything that's happened since, that was baked in now. It's about the activity on the ground. I go around speaking to lots of branches, mostly in London, obviously, given my role. But tomorrow night I'm in Surrey, where an area that had elections cancelled. Now, I don't know how we would have done in those elections in that particular county, but I've been to branches in Essex where the elections would have been fantastic if we'd been allowed to have them.
Where I live in Kent, I mean, it's now the Kent County Council. I think there are around 85 seats and Reform have 67 or something like that, which I don't think anybody would have predicted. So I think you're absolutely right in what you say about the local elections. But I was listening to something earlier on and someone was saying, well, in fact, I think it was Dominic Cummings in this interview, saying that if Nigel Farage is serious about power, he's got to be able to unveil a sort of putative shadow cabinet on stage at a party conference at some point. And at the moment, the general public really only know him and possibly Richard Tice, as one or two others are starting to get a profile. But, I mean, we find it difficult, I think, on LBC, trying to get a variety of Reform voices onto the station because there aren't that many that are really capable of doing it. That's not a criticism, but it's always the way with a new party. So that's the challenge, isn't it, for the next 4 years, to grow the number of people. I mean, who would he have as Foreign Secretary? Who would he have as Defence Secretary? I haven't a clue, do you?
Well, I think...
Which do you fancy?
I'm always happy to come on your show, Ian, and indeed any show on LBC, apart from perhaps James O'Brien. But
cruel.
Which actually I leave on in the background if the dogs have been naughty and I have to abandon them for a couple of hours. But we are growing the team. There will be... Look, we've got two fantastic mayors elected at the same time as these council elections. You'll be seeing a lot more of those, I'm sure, as we move forwards. See, Sarah Poachin is our new MP in Runcorn and Helsby. She she's absolutely chomping at the bit to get stuck into issues on crime and justice policing, given her background as a magistrate and the experience that she has. So that we are growing the team. And the more by-elections we win, the more MPs we get elected, the more people, the higher profile, you'll see that. And you know, perhaps these council leaders as well, the once they've settled in and done their job. So we're growing the team at all levels.
Naomi Smith, this is your vision of hell, isn't it?
Well, look, all I can say is, in the direct answer to Martin, no. Look at the polls. Reform UK don't need much help at the moment. Look at the election results. Look at what's actually happening. You mentioned some of their local election victories, and Alex mentioned the mayoral and the Westminster by-election up in Runcorn. I don't think the party can cope with two egos the size of Dominic Cummings and Nigel Farage's. Dominic Cummings famously likes to move fast and break things, and if things don't go his way, he's not afraid to you know, have a tantrum about it. So
there's an analogy here, isn't there, between Trump and Elon Musk? This is
well,
the
indeed,
British equivalent.
Indeed. Well, I mean, I'm sure Dominic Cummings would love to be quite as rich and successful as Elon Musk, and I'm not sure Farage is Elon either. So look, I think that Dominic Cummings is in search of pastures new, probably bored of his time sub-sacking in the wilderness, wants a little bit more influence. But do I think Reform UK need him? Absolutely not.
Chris Curtis, I don't know if you want to put your pollster hat back on here, but Reform are now at 31% in the latest opinion poll. I don't think anyone would have predicted that even a few months ago. They're consistently ahead of Labour and the Conservatives. Would Nigel Farage be well advised to get some outside advice?
I'll comment on the polling and then I'll comment on that if that's all right. I mean, on the polling, that it's certainly true that, you know, we're struggling with, let's generously call it, midterm blues in the polls at the moment, and Reform are doing
midterm after 10 months.
Reform are doing all right. But actually, when you look at the YouGov poll yesterday, for example, when it comes to that key question, which I think we're now fairly confident the next election is going to be fought on, do you want Keir Starmer to be Prime Minister or do you want Nigel Farage to be Prime Minister? Actually, Keir Starmer holds a comfortable lead over Nigel Farage on that key question among almost all demographic groups in this country. So when it comes to the actually quite important question, should Farage get advice from Dominic Cummings, I'd say that there's two things that Farage should probably look for first. The first of which is a calculator, because if you heard his speech the other day where he announced billions of pounds worth of tax cuts and £1 billion worth of extra spending, I'm sorry, but that just don't add up. And the second thing that he could probably do with is a chat with my grandmother, who is reliant on our national service almost every single day of her life at the moment. And Farage's plan for the NHS, as far as I can see, is to privatise it.
Simply not true.
Well, he said as much.
Simply not true. We have always said that the NHS and treatment that people receive on the NHS will remain free at the point in which we are not, you know, absolutely despicable leaflets that are being published in the Runcorn by-election. You know, Labour leaders.
I won't take any comment on despicable leaflets, given what you guys are putting out in Scotland, I have to say, which is as close as I've ever seen to racism being put out on content in this country. But before we get to that, Farage has made comments about our NHS which I think are unsustainable. They may be U-turning their position now. I hope they're U-turning their position now.
I think he proposed an insurance system, didn't he?
Yes, which would be dreadful for many people in this country and also incredibly expensive. When we've seen insurance systems, they're far more inefficient and that's going to deny service to people
who need...
But
they get better outcomes.
Well, look at what we've seen in the US.
No,
there's
yeah,
not necessarily
people on the left always go to the US. You don't mention France, you don't mention Germany, you don't mention Spain.
When Labour last left power, our system, our National Health Service system, was one of the most efficiently run, with some of the best outcomes of anywhere in the world for less cost than what you pay elsewhere. I said one of the best. It had fantastic outcomes. It had some of the highest satisfaction rates in its history by the time we've left office. It's been ruined by 14 years of austerity under the Tories. We need to bring that back again. But anyone who thinks that privatisation of our NHS is the way forward is wrong, and we need to stand up to that. And if they go and chat to my 91-year-old grandmother, they'd realise that pretty quickly.
Okay, Angela Epstein.
Well, look, the election is Reform's to win, if there are an election now, because it's Labour's to lose. Their popularity is through the floor. They've sold out the farmers, they've sold out pensioners with the winter fuel. I know they're rowing back now. The fishermen handing over our fishing rights for 12 years. The popularity is you know, there is just no popularity there. And Starmer himself, you know, he's probably one, I can't remember what the exact poll said, but he's one of the least popular popular newly invested prime ministers on record. So, you know, there is absolutely no public confidence in Labour. He flip-flops, he's a weather vane, he chops and changes, nobody knows what he stands for, and the party, and let's not even get on to Rachel Reeves and the sky-high tax burden, which is going to be even more, come October, more likely. So reform is there, because what's happened is that reform have kind of supplanted the Tories, regrettably at the moment, as the party of the right. They're saying all the things that people want to hear about tackling soaring inflation. They don't have any truck with woke politics. What ordinary people want to hear is, how are their lives going to be improved? How's the money in their pocket going to go further? And Nigel Farage, who has got a huge talent when it comes to connecting with people, is saying all the right things. I take the point about the costings, which are bonkers.
I mean, you might as well be promising people a free rocket journey on that thing that okay. Katy Perry went on, and everybody to have free lollipops.
I recognise that.
If our politics brings comes down to just being able
Hang
to promise
second,
loads of things you can't
you.
Afford.
Yeah, Chris, I did listen to you at length. But the thing is that he's saying things also that appeal to Labour voters, you know, about the two-cap child benefit, about winter fuel, all of those things. We don't really know what he stands for. So at the moment, from what I hear on the ground from ordinary people, is they're pig sick of Labour. The Conservatives have got a long way to go in order to regroup. So they see reform as some kind of alternative. It's almost like a protest vote. And it's almost like at this stage, they don't even care what Ian was saying about how do you summon the right number of personalities, who would be Foreign Secretary. People don't care. Reform has just become a soundbite for saying, I'm just fed up with the rest of you lot. And it would be interesting, should Nigel Farage ever step away, I would wager whether that kind of support would stay, Cummings or otherwise. And quickly on the point of Cummings, I think he drags so much baggage in terms of the way he allegedly shafted Boris and all the ways that he behaved afterwards.
I don't think there's any allegedly about it.
Well, I'm just covering myself. Many lawyers in the family.
I've just finished reading Boris's book.
Okay. It's going to go on your tab then. But the point is that I don't think having that kind of personality come in is going to do much for reform's fortunes.
Right. Caroline says, Ian needs to address the comments made regarding his fellow presenter. Does he not realise the cameras are on and his smiling is not helpful? Sorry that I smiled over something I found vaguely amusing, but somebody else says, Jess says, sorry, Alex would be scared to death to go on James O'Brien's show because James would hold him to account and rip him to shreds. Please read this out, says Tess. Well, I've done my duty. Do you fancy an encounter with James O'Brien, Alex? I'm sure I could arrange it.
Well, we'll see.
I think you've got quite a poker face, actually, Ian. I can't read it. I think we can't.
I don't think he'd like
it's
to have
inscrutable,
me
on, I think you are.
I'm not so sure about that. Right, let's go to a break before we hear from Jay in my hometown of Saffron Walden. It's 9:15.
This is LBC.
Bring your pensions together with PensionBee and take control of your retirement. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to skip traffic and glide to wherever you need to be. With headspace to focus on more important matters. Like if that cloud is a starfish or sunflower. Fast journeys without the rush with great deals at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
The British Red Cross is here to welcome people fleeing the conflict in Ukraine.
We're here to help people to safety when storms hit.
We're here to show anyone struggling that someone cares.
Hiya, that's a huge help.
We're here for humanity. With your support, the Red Cross has helped millions of people in the UK and 190 other countries. Search British Red Cross to support us. Together, we are the world's emergency responders.
Angela Rippon, what are you doing here?
I've come to tell you about using energy flexibly, Albert.
Flexibly?
Yes, smart meter owners could get rewarded for moving their energy use, like doing the laundry at off-peak times.
So I don't need to do the splits?
No, Albert. Nobody wants to see that.
Get rewarded for using energy flexibly, only with a smart meter. Search Get a Smart Meter today.
Eligibility and availability vary. Consumer action required. Reward schemes and tariffs available to selected customers from selected suppliers.
Hillary's mid-season sale just got even better. Get up to 40% off hundreds of made-to-measure styles. Plus, get an extra 10% off absolutely everything. That's 10% off all blinds, curtains and shutters. And an extra 10% off our new range of awnings and pergolas, with measuring and fitting always included. Book your free in-home appointment today. visit hillarys.co.uk. Hurry, Hillary's extra 10% off everything must end 2nd of June. Conditions apply.
Cross Question with Ian Dale on LBC. Text 84850.
8:48. Jay in Saffron Walden is on the line. Jay, very good evening. Always good to hear from someone from Saffron Walden. What would you like to ask?
Good evening, Ian. Good evening, panel. The free speech warrior Donald Trump is waging a war against foreign students and universities. Should UK government welcome all those students who is going to be leaving soon America?
Good question. Now, as the Trump administration's battle with Harvard University over claims of anti-Semitism on campus, the university could be at risk of losing up to $100 million of contracts with the US government, having also lost the ability to enrol any international students last week. The UK government has also proposed a 6% tax on the income which universities here make from international students, along with reducing the length of student visas. What is going on here? I mean, not just in America, but in this country, I'd have thought that any country would welcome as many foreign students as wanted to come, as evidence that their universities are high quality. Chris Curtis, let's start with you.
Well, I mean, look, we need to get net migration down, and we know that there have been some problems with student visas pushing those numbers up. As a point that is worth noting, more generally, we need to make sure that we are attracting the best and brightest talent here to the UK, particularly to come and study postgraduates, because we know that they are going to be the backbone of the new high-tech industries that this country is going to rely on to grow our economy in the coming years. And we also need to proudly and loudly talk about our fantastic universities here in the UK. I mean, if you move outside the US, we've got top three universities in the world here in the UK, supporting our economy, supporting our industry. And there's spin-out companies from them that are leading the world here in London, in Oxford and Cambridge, and across the rest of the country. It's important for our regions as well. We have fantastic universities in many of our northern towns and cities as well. It has become popular. We've seen it in the US. We've seen a little bit here in the UK to talk down our universities. And we shouldn't do that. They are fantastic institutions that are really important.
What ones which you want for your people to come to?
Well, ones that we need to continue to support and attract the brightest and the best from right across the world to come and study in. And our immigration system needs to appreciate that and support that as well.
But they're not immigrants. I mean, why even include them in the figures?
Our visa system needs to support and encourage that as well. But look, we've done fantastic at this. And you visit Oxford and Cambridge and you see some of the brightest engineers, people working in the tech sector, computer scientists all around the world working on some of the most creative problems, biotech, pharmaceuticals. And we do need to continue to support that.
But it isn't those universities that are going to be necessarily affected here. It's going to be ones like my old university in Norwich, where they are very reliant on foreign students, and they're seeing a huge drop off in foreign students at the moment because they're almost being discouraged to come here. So it's not the big universities, it's some of the others that may well face huge financial problems.
Moving the topic slightly from the economy there onto one which is a little bit more about migration, and on this point, look, you know, we have, whether through our universities, a lot of our public services, our care sector, become reliant on migration to solve problems because we can't be bothered to pay for it, basically. Our companies, rather than thinking about how they skill up British people or pay decent wages, have been reliant on low-skilled migration. Our universities, because we haven't bothered to fund them properly, have become reliant on foreign students. Actually, it is not healthy for a country to be reliant on migration to solve its problems. And this government is determined to lower those net migration numbers and ensure that that reliance ends. Now, does that mean that we should stop the brightest people from across the world come here to support our economy? No, it doesn't. But it does mean moving our public services and our economy and our businesses away from that reliance on migration in the future.
Alex?
Well, Chris has dealt with the part of the question talking about the UK university, so I'll perhaps talk about the situation in the US and what Donald Trump is doing. And you need to remember why he's doing that. It's because we have seen such absolutely unforgivable outbreaks of anti-Semitism on those university campuses. You know, since October the 7th, anti-Semitism has gone off the scale in the US, in Europe, in London. You know, we have the marches, you know, near enough every week. And that's something that simply cannot be tolerated. We see where that ends. Yeah, we saw it in the 30s. We're not going to... You know, never again is now. And we've got to make sure that things like that don't happen again. And yeah, there's always a role for you know, peaceful protest and people explain their views and so on. That's absolutely fine.
Okay, should we take these students that aren't going to be allowed to go to America?
Not if they're going to be carrying out that kind of activity.
But he seems to... I think the latest move that he's made is to say that no foreign students can go and study in American universities.
He's using that as he does. He goes in with a big kind of, you know, big stick to beat people with or institutions with, but the reason he's doing it is because he wants to tackle anti-Semitism on US campuses, and that is exactly the right approach or the right principle to be following.
So it's foreign students that are doing the anti-Semitism, it's not American students?
It's probably a mixture, but it's certainly there are some that
so why just penalise foreign students?
Because
shut down the universities then.
Well, the universities need to take their responsibilities on this subject seriously, and if this is the way to make that happen, then this is the way to make it happen.
Yeah, okay, so I've got quite a bit of skin in the game here as being Jewish myself and having been seen firsthand what Jewish students in this country, I've got a daughter who's a student on campus, have been going through. It is absolutely appalling. The amount of hatred that is festering across campuses in this country should make us all hang our heads in shame. As you say, Alex, nothing to do with legitimate political debate or criticism. I'm all for that. It's supposed to be. University's supposed to be for that. They've become places of hatred on campus. Donald Trump, classically, has gone in with perhaps the right motive. Yes, we need to fight all racism, not just anti-Semitism and squash extremism, but he's doing it in such a broad brush kind of bonkers way that it's not proportionate and it's not controlled. There is a way of enjoying foreign students here and vice versa. My own daughter is about to go on a reciprocal scheme with her university and she's going abroad for a year and somebody's coming here. Those things are fantastic. We've had things like Rhodes Scholars. There are ways of enjoying foreign students coming here and our students becoming the so-called foreign students there. That's all fantastic. But I think just to have them here as some kind of money-making machine completely throws, you know, it completely throws the idea of what universities are all about, which is, as Chris says, attracting the brightest minds to have imaginative discussions. Obviously, there are vocational courses here, not just somewhere that can generate income. We have
What's
to make
wrong with generating income. In
that's fine
because it subsidises British students, so there can be more British students.
Yes, but okay, it's fine if you generate income as a consequence of having the brightest minds here, but not being your pure motivating fact.
Naomi, I'm going to ask you to be brief on this one because the next question...
I'm going to be so brief. Not only should we take foreign students out of net migration figures and accept as many foreign student applicants to Harvard, we should accept Harvard. Harvard should leave the USA. I propose Doncaster.
They can come to Milton Keynes.
No, you've got enough in that area.
In
Saffron Walden, you've got Cambridge, etc. nearby. But Doncaster, it's got all those wonderful infrastructure links, A1M, M1, brilliant rail, no university yet. Harvard, Doncaster.
And it has a reform council as well.
There you go.
She's just changed her mind now. Right, let's go to a text question from Harriet in Dorking. Our ambassador to America, Peter Mandelson, says the New Deal with the EU is the foundation of a reset and not the end of it. How far should this reset go, Naomi Smith?
It needs to deliver on the promises. So there's some big promises made by both Ursula von der Leyen and Keir Starmer at the summit last week on dynamic alignment for agri-food, on a youth mobility scheme, very crucially on defence.
Well, they didn't get very far on that, did they?
No, and so they need to. They need to deliver on that. They need to get the growth. I was not privy to negotiations, which may surprise you, Ian, because it was never meant to be anything other than an agreement to agree in the future on things. We were never expecting it to be a bells and whistles. Well, then that's a comms failure because it was always going to be a kind of political declaration. But what we have now got is annual summits baked in. We know that that's going to happen. We know that the EU need to go and get their mandate to go ahead with all of this. And both sides need to deliver on this for the growth that both of us need to get from that, both EU side and UK side.
And do you think that Brexiteers are right to fear the consequences of this, that it is sort of maybe not rejoining the EU, but it's kind of going in that direction by stealth?
No, because our businesses desperately need it and want it, and it's all within the red lines that were in the manifesto that the Labour government was elected on last year. No rejoining of the Single Market Customs Union or return to freedom of movement, much as some people, like me, would have loved all of those things. So no, nothing to fear, much to gain, particularly on economic growth.
Short answers from the rest of you, please. Chris?
I agree with Naomi.
Very short. Angela?
Couldn't disagree more. Starmer spent years trying to get a second referendum. He was the shadow Brexit secretary in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet. It should be a shame that he was in his shadow cabinet at all. He sold us out on the fishing deal, on the fishing vessels. He sold us out on looser border controls. The defence pact that we're going to have to pay to even get a chance of being part of the EU defence pact. He is nudging his way towards not greater alignment. He wants to reverse Brexit in all but name. And I just think it's outrageous. 17,410,742 people voted for Brexit. That's more votes than Labour got in the last election. He should be honouring that.
Alex?
It's more votes than any party has ever won in any election in the history of democracy in this country. It's the single biggest mandate electorally was the vote to leave, and it needs to be upheld. So in the interest of a short answer, I agree with Angela.
Okay. Right. Our fun question from Gracie in Stirling. Three children have been named as the stars of a new TV series reboot of the Harry Potter books. Which other classic TV show or film also deserves a reboot? Chris.
When I was young, my favourite TV programme was Jungle Run, and I always wanted to go on it and never got to go on it, so I'd like to bring that back, but they've got to let adults on this time. So I can go
an
back
an MP's
Jungle Run.
Jungle Run.
Yeah.
I have to say, I've never heard of it. But
you can come on as well.
You're half my age.
You do it as a team, so we'll do it as a
team. Okay, right. Naomi.
Steven Spielberg's The Goonies. I watched that on repeat many times as a child, and I want the next generation to have as much joy from it with a remake as I did when I was young.
Angela.
Well, I was going to say Lassie, but then dog owners have become so militant these days that it's really put me off doing that. So I'm going to stay in the animal theme and go for Black Beauty, because I love that horse.
Love the theme tune.
Reborn as
I could sing it to you if you want, but
please,
I won't.
No.
Didn't she? She got reborn on the Lloyds Bank advert anyway, didn't she?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I Black Beauty was absolutely
fabulous.
Brilliant. Do you remember Follyfoot as well?
Yeah,
Follyfoot Farm. I remember.
Skippy the Bush Kangaroo, that'd be my choice.
Skippy, yeah.
Alex.
I think some things are best left untouched, and you know, they were good in their heyday, excellent TV shows. Bringing them back only makes them worse. So, I mean, I really enjoyed Yes, Prime Minister, but the remake of that was shocking. So I think let's not ruin things by trying to reinvent
the wheel. Does that mean you don't want the Spice Girls to get back together?
Yes, I don't. Definitely don't. Right, thank you all very much indeed. Monday's panel includes the General Secretary of Britain's largest trade union, Unison, Christine McEnany, Conservative...